Blackstone Audio presents A Purely Private Matter, A Rosalind Thorne Mystery by Darcy Wilde. This book is read by Sarah Nichols. Chapter 1. The Art of Obtaining Discreet Entry. Avoid as much as possible going out in the evening, especially on frivolous errands. Samuel Adams, The Complete Servant.
"How will you get inside?"
Mrs. De Vere's question echoed in the back of Rosalind Thorne's mind as she climbed out of the hired carriage.
"They do not admit women at Graham's."
That was the first problem. Had Rosalind needed to get inside a respectable house, she could have followed the daisy chain of her acquaintance to find a plausible reason for visiting. There were, however, limits to even Rosalind's carefully cultivated connections. Fashioning an anonymous admission to one of the most exclusive gaming clubs in Pall Mall had proved beyond her powers until tonight. Tonight, Graham's was holding its Selenite Ball. Once a year, the club members welcomed London society's richest and most riotous inhabitants. Champagne and brandy would flow, and tables would groan under the weight of the food prepared by the club's French chef, and most important for Rosalind's purposes, women would be welcomed into the club's exclusively masculine preserve. Rosalind clutched her blue silk cloak closed with one hand and held her white and silver face mask with the other as she shouldered her way through the opulent crowd. Ladies and gentlemen done up in enough colours to outfit 100 stained glass windows jammed the steps. Precious stones, some of which were surely genuine, sparkled on every throat, bosom and brow. Rosalind was not the only woman to affect a mask. Creations of gold lace and peacock feathers adorned the faces of some who did not scruple to expose their shoulders, arms, bosoms, and most daringly, their ankles. Graham's Club had three sets of doors facing St. James Street, and all of them stood wide open in an attempt to accommodate the flood of fashionable visitors. Rosalind selected the doors farthest to the right and inserted herself into the party-coloured current with the efficient yet unobtrusive sidestep she'd perfected for navigating crowded ballrooms. When she reached the golden doorway, the liveried footman shook his head at her until all his chins wagged.
"Now then, ma'am, I will need to see your invitation."
Rosalind was as devoid of invitation as she was of any intention to join the festivities. She stepped closer to the footman and, in a familiar manner that would have shocked any respectable house or manservant, took his hand.
"I am here to meet a friend," she breathed as she pressed the coin into his palm.
The man looked at her mask and closed his hand around the coin. He also stepped back and bowed deeply. Rosalind gathered her hems and sailed past him with a straight back and smooth step that would have made her old deportment master smile.
"How will you know where to go?" Mrs. De Vere had asked. "You will not know what the place looks like inside."
This much, at least, was easy to solve. The circulating library kept a number of guidebooks describing the more notorious sights and haunts of London. The article in Clubs of the Metropolis, A Comprehensive Guide, had proved most detailed. Rosalind looked about her now, matching that description to what she saw. Dozens of flambeaux and beeswax candles lit Graham's marble entrance hall. A pair of brightly rouged women in low-cut gowns of pale green silk glanced curiously at Rosalind, but did not pause as they joined the shining river that flowed up the famous, according to the guidebook, marble and gilt stairs. On either side of that sweeping stairway stood a pair of poorly executed, larger-than-life, gilded statues of naked women. They were crowned in stars and holding aloft fans of playing cards in one hand, while the other beckoned the members to come try their luck. These were meant to be representations of the goddess of fortune. Privately, Rosalind thought the goddess of fortune should have a word with her solicitor.
"But surely you'll be recognised."
That had been a genuine worry. Graham's counted many sons of aristocratic families among its members. Rosalind could not risk being seen unescorted in a place she had no business even entering. That meant not one, but two disguises became necessary,
the first to get her through the door, and the second to render her invisible once she was inside. It also meant that she could not make use of the attended cloakroom or retiring room to effect her transformation. But as she had hoped, behind each of the great gilded statues, there was a narrow, shadowed space that was simple enough for Rosalind to fade into. Keeping her motions small and quick, Rosalind drew off her mask and unfastened her cape. Underneath, she wore a plain black dress. The addition of a white collar and plain cuffs made the garment originally designed for mourning into a passing imitation of a lady's maid's severe dress. She had pulled her golden hair into a simple knot at the back of her neck and left off even the most modest pins or jewels. Instead of a reticule, she carried a plain work bag for holding thread and scissors, scraps of lace, and other needlework. Presto, thought Rosalind to herself, as she smoothed the cloak over her arm. It was not as easy to imitate a servant as one might be led to believe from stage plays and three-volume novels. In addition to the 1,000 highly specialized forms and skills that a life in service demanded, there were habits of motion and attitude that were difficult to assume without training and continual practice. Therefore, Rosalind had waited until after midnight to make her attempt. By now, the majority of the guests were quite drunk. The rest were concentrating on getting drunk or taking advantage of others' drunkenness. Under these circumstances, the finer details of her dress and demeanour ought to pass unnoticed. Rosalind slipped into the very edge of the crowd and let herself be carried by mutual motion up the stairs. If anyone asked what she did here, which was unlikely, she could say she was taking the silk cloak to her mistress, who wished to leave without delay. Rosalind reached the first floor. Clarence blue carpets softened the floors. More gilded statues in the style of those downstairs guarded the entrance to a hive of galleries and salons. Music and laughter filled the whole building as men and women danced and drank and crowded around the tables. The new game of La Roulette was also on full display, and to judge by the cheers thundering through the gaming rooms, was proving a magnificent success. Rosalind turned her face away from that gaudy door. Fortunes would be lost tonight. Women as well as men would be swept up by the excitement, and they would commit sin and folly to be allowed to continue to play. It was that sort of folly which brought her here tonight, and what she needed was not to be found on this floor. Rosalind breezed past the gaming rooms, making her way to the plainer stair at the end of the passageway.
"I am at my wit's end, Miss Thorne. You must help me."
Mrs. Percival de Verry, nay, Lucille Allenby, had cried as she sat in Rosalind's small parlour and poured out her story. Rosalind Thorne had a reputation as what society called a useful woman. Usually, this referred to some gently bred woman in distressed circumstances who managed to keep a kind of position in the fashionable world by helping her better-off sisters organise their visiting lists and entertainments, as well as running those errands that these more fortunate women found too fatiguing. But recently and singularly, Rosalind had enlarged upon her occupation. She had begun to help women with their more serious problems, the problems that could affect lives, marriages, and families. Rosalind listened to Mrs. de Verry's halting description of how she had come to this city as a new bride, and how her husband had introduced her to society. Society, in its turn, had introduced Mrs. de Verry to cards. She quickly took to the games and enjoyed them enough that she found herself playing deeper than her income allowed. In order to keep playing, she had borrowed money from a man named Russell Fullerton.
"He was so charming, so understanding," Mrs. de Verry told Rosalind miserably. "If I had known what kind of man he was, if I had any idea."
But no one among her new acquaintances had thought to warn her. Not even when Mr. Fullerton had asked her to give him her cameo brooch as a promise that she would repay his loan. But although she did repay him, that brooch had not been returned. Then the letters had started to come, and the demands for more money began.
"And you have been paying?"
"I have, or at least I have tried, but he wants so much, Miss Thorne."
Rosalind mounted the narrower, quieter stair that led to the club's second floor with a firm step. My advice, Mrs. Devery, is that you tell your husband the truth. If he cares for you, he will forgive you.
Mr. Fullerton has threatened to take the story to the papers. My husband is in the House of Commons, Miss Thorne. The scandal would destroy his career. He would not forgive that.
The hallway of the second floor was deep in shadow. The windows at either end admitted some flickering light from the street outside, but no candles had been lit here to alleviate the dark, or the cold, because no one was expected to be up here this early. Like most clubs of its kind, Graham's kept rooms that could be reserved by those who had no wish to bother travelling London's streets to get to their tables. Some gentlemen, in fact, lived almost exclusively at their clubs, either for the convenience of the location or to avoid the entanglements of hearth and home. Mr. Fullerton was one of these. Rosalind had bribed Graham's servants for information well before she ever set foot in the club. A glass of gin and a few coins had enabled her to discover that Mr. Fullerton occupied the corner suite on the second floor. Rosalind kept her gait steady as she moved down the darkened and silent corridor. To look furtive would be the greatest folly. She must act as if she was under orders to be in this exact spot. She reached the door that should lead to the corner apartment and stopped in the puddle of orange light that flickered through the arched window. This point had always been the weakness of the plan and the question for which there was no answer. Was the door locked? It might not be. Mr. Fullerton was in the club, after all, down in the gaming rooms, enjoying the rout and riot. But then, he was a blackmailer and therefore not a trusting soul. If he'd locked his door, then Rosalind would need to find where the housekeeper stored the keys. That would take her into the realm of the servants, which would be risky beyond measure. The masters might all be drunk and distracted tonight, but their attendants most certainly were not. But she glanced at the floor and saw a bright line of light gleaming at the level of the carpet. There was a fire in the room. That might mean the door was open, but it also might mean that there was someone in the rooms. Rosalind's heart thumped once, but she did not permit herself to hesitate. She knocked softly, as a servant alerting those within she was about to enter. There was no answer. Rosalind's heart thumped again. She closed her hand around the doorknob. It turned, and the door opened quietly. Rosalind resisted the urge to dart inside and kept her movements sedate, at least until she closed the door behind herself and drew the bolt.
"He told me he keeps my cameo in the drawer of his bedside table, so that he has it near him always."
Mr. Fullerton would have had no fear of divulging this little detail to Mrs. Devery. A young lady of her class would never be admitted into a gentleman's club, much less his private rooms. Except for one reason, of course, and Mrs. Devery had been painfully aware of this.
I think he may eventually demand more from me than money."
Mr. Fullerton clearly revelled in his high living, and Rosalind felt certain he must have had these apartments privately furnished. Despite the display of guilt and excess downstairs, Rosalind could not believe that the club provided all its members with such a profusion of silks and velvet, marble tops, and painted enamel handles. A beautiful little marquetry table waited beside a luxuriously curtained bed. Rosalind put her hand to the ornate drawer and held her breath. The drawer didn't budge. Mr. Fullerton, it seemed, was not entirely careless. Rosalind bit her lip and quickly reached into her work bag to pull out the sandalwood letter opener she'd brought against this possibility. Rosalind had been gently reared, but some of that gentle upbringing had included a girls' boarding school, a place where one might gain experience with all manner of petty larcenies. Rosalind's hands had not lost their touch, and Mr. Fullerton's drawer proved no more difficult than the headmistress's desk had. When she slid it open, she found half a dozen articles of jewellery in that drawer. Rosalind saw a garnet ring, a pearl collar, and a figured brooch. Mrs. Devery had clearly not been Fullerton's only victim. There were also several packets of letters tied in silk ribbon.
"Did you send him any letters?" Rosalind had asked Mrs. Devery. "Any at all? Even a brief note?" "No, I did not. Everything was communicated through my old nurse. She is still as sharp as she ever was, and is sincerely attached to me.
It would seem, however, that there were other ladies who were not so careful. Still, those letters were not Rosalind's business. She was here for the white and sepia cameo that was a portrait of Mrs. De Vere's grandmother, framed in gold and tiny diamonds. Before she began to plot her entry into the club, Rosalind had visited Mrs. De Vere's jeweller. That careful artisan had kept the description and pattern of the cameo. Many ladies had copies of their jewels made so that the originals could be stored for safekeeping or sold without their families being the wiser. The jeweller was quite happy to duplicate the cameo in paste and resin, and did not demur at the alterations Rosalind requested. Now Rosalind claimed the original cameo and in its place dropped the copy from her work bag into the drawer. She looked again at the packets of correspondence and hesitated. Then she took up the letters and tucked them away as well. She closed the drawer. There would be no way to relock it, but that could not be helped. Hopefully, Mr. Fullerton would think his thief had just been after the letters and not consider the jewels left behind. There, done. As long as she could manage her exit. Rosalind slipped once more into the hallway. She strained her ears for the sounds of bells or the cry of the watch for some indication as to the time, but heard neither. It was a far different sound that broke the cool silence.
"You there!"
The woman's voice stopped Rosalind in her tracks.
"Come here and help me fix this thing."
Rosalind stood paralyzed for a handful of frantic heartbeats before she gathered herself. It was not the command that held her frozen. It was that she recognized the woman's voice.
"Charlotte?" she thought,
but immediately caught herself. "No, it is not possible."
"I must get my mistress her wrap," she murmured, without turning around. "Never mind your mistress. Come and help me." "No, it is not her. This voice is too low. The accents are wrong."
Rosalind turned to face the woman who stood at the top of the stairs. The flickering torchlight glimmered on a dress of pale silk and netting. In one hand, the woman held a swath of gauze that had clearly been torn at the shoulder. Rosalind gathered her nerve, but her answer was cut off by the sound of footsteps on the stairs.
"There you are, my dear Cynthia."
A slim man with his hair swept back from his forehead trotted up the stairs.
"I thought I'd lost you." "Ferdinand!"
The woman in silver turned at once. Rosalind was so quickly dismissed from all consideration, she might as well have dropped through the floor.
"You frightened me. Feel how my heart beats."
The woman lifted the man's hand to her breast and laid it there. Rosalind dropped her gaze. She knew she should retire. If she had been a real servant, she would have known how to retreat and where the back stairs were located. But she was not, and these two blocked her only exit.
"Ah, a thousand curses upon me as a fool," murmured Ferdinand, stepping closer to the woman and lacing his arm tightly through hers. "Come, let me find you some champagne. You will drink until you are quite calm again."
"But my dress?"
The woman pulled the torn gauze from her shoulder.
"I cannot be seen like this."
Tenderly, the man took the netting and draped it around her throat, arranging it with great care.
"Then I shall take you where you cannot be seen."
The woman lifted her face to his. They linked arms at once and hurried down the corridor, away from the stairs and Rosalind, leaving her alone, forgotten, and entirely safe from all risk of exposure. This fact barely touched her. In her mind, Rosalind was miles and years away. She stood in another darkened hallway, watching another young woman, slimmer, more plainly dressed, run through another door. Despair, confusion, and betrayal washed through Rosalind, as clear and sharp as if she were still a girl, on the night when she watched her sister, Charlotte, disappear. Chapter 2. A New Acquaintance. Gentlemen, if we are to regard our friends with such constant suspicion, if we are to be jealous of the wives of our bosom, we had infinitely better close our doors against society altogether. The Trial of Birch versus Neil for Criminal Conversation. It was early in the grey, grim, grimy London morning, and Rosalind Thorne was entirely exhausted.
She hadn't even been to bed. After leaving Graham's, she'd been able to return home just long enough to change out of her lady's maid costume. She'd promised to return the cameo to Mrs. De Vere before her household was awake. Once there, she'd needed to stay long enough to make sure the young woman not only heard but retained her instructions. Mrs. De Vere was to confess her debts to her husband. She was to face Mr. Fullerton calmly when she produced the original of the cameo, but to speak to him no more than was strictly necessary, and on no account to allow herself to be alone with him. If Fullerton made any additional threats or demands, Mrs. De Vere was to write to Rosalind at once. Mrs. De Vere was also to make sure she gave her old nurse a token of gratitude to help ensure the loyal woman remained loyal, despite any additional provocations or bribes that might be offered. On the long, jostling ride back through the morning traffic of vans, carts, and sheep flocks, Rosalind kept herself awake by considering what to do with the letters she had stolen from Fullerton's drawer. Probably they were additional fuel for his blackmail. Therefore, the wisest, simplest, and most honourable course of action was to burn them all unopened. This firm and sensible thought warred with the image of the woman retreating into the darkness with her lover. It raised in her the unworthy idea that Mr. Fullerton might be someone she needed to speak with in the near future, and if she did, she would need to have some way to encourage him to answer her. With all that ringing through her head and her conscience, Rosalind entirely forgot she'd agreed to receive her friend Alice Littlefield until the moment she walked back into her house.
"Oh, Rosalind, at last!"
Alice darted out of the parlour just at the moment Rosalind entered the cramped front hall. Mrs. Kendricks, the housekeeper, was caught with her mouth open.
"I was beginning to think we'd miss you all together."
Alice gave Rosalind a quick kiss on the cheek.
"I've brought Mrs. Seymour, as I told you, and I have promised her faithfully you will not turn her away."
She paused.
"What is the matter? Are you unwell?"
"No, I'm perfectly well, thank you," Rosalind replied. "I'm sorry I was so long. The appointment this morning turned out to be more complicated than I had hoped." Rosalind left her coat, bonnet, and a request for coffee with Mrs. Kendricks, and allowed Alice to seize her hand to draw her into the tiny, tidy parlour.
"Rosalind," said Alice, "this is my friend, Mrs. William Seymour. Margaretta, may I introduce Miss Rosalind Thorne?"
Mrs. Seymour stood, and she and Rosalind both made their curtsies. "How do you do, Miss Thorne?" Mrs. Seymour's voice was unusually low for a woman's, and held a distinct musical tone. "Thank you for agreeing to see me, especially at such an hour." Had Alice been alone or with her brother George, Rosalind might have just confessed to her midnight adventure and asked to be excused, but this Mrs. Seymour was a stranger. Therefore, etiquette must take precedence over exhaustion. "A pleasure to meet you, Mrs. Seymour," said Rosalind. "Won't you please sit down?" Mrs. Seymour settled onto Rosalind's sofa beside Alice, while Rosalind took her usual chair by the fireplace. Mrs. Seymour was a striking woman. She had left the flush of youth behind, but she was one of those ladies whom time had bloomed rather than withered. She had a wealth of dark hair that was dressed simply. Her eyes were likewise dark and wide-set. Her matron's summer gown was cream and apricot, without lace or ribbon. Its simplicity spoke not only of excellent taste, but of the easy poise so prized by members of the Autant. Mrs. Seymour took Rosalind in with a glance of those dark eyes, assessing her quickly, and showing Rosalind there was a sharp mind behind that beauty.
"Mrs. Seymour is a poetess," said Alice, "and a ballad writer."
Mrs. Seymour inclined her head with studied modesty. This explained how she came to know Alice. Like Rosalind, tiny, quick, dark Alice Littlefield had been born into the aristocracy, but her father had squandered his fortune, and his children were left to make shift for themselves. Now, Alice kept house with her brother George, and made her living as a writer for newspapers and annuals. This change of station had gained Alice a large and eccentric acquaintance throughout London's literary world.
"Do you want me to begin, Margaretta?"
Alice asked Mrs. Seymour. "No. This once I will tell my own story, even if I never do so again." Mrs. Seymour straightened her shoulders, and Rosalind had the distinct sensation of an actress striking a pose.
You have before you, Miss Thorne, a woman on the edge of public disgrace. Mrs. Seymour paused, possibly expecting a gasp of horror or pity. Rosalind did not oblige. I am sorry to hear it, Mrs. Seymour. What form of disgrace are we speaking of? Mrs. Seymour looked to Alice a little disappointed. Alice shrugged. I did warn you, Margaretta. Rosalind is not easily shaken. I see that, said Mrs. Seymour. I can be direct, then. My husband, Miss Thorne, is threatening to file suit for criminal conversation. Ah. English law had many complexities and strange aspects. One of the strangest and most frustrating from Rosalind's point of view was the tort of criminal conversation. According to the law, a man and wife were considered a single body, his, naturally. The act of unsanctioned intercourse between a married woman and a man other than her lawfully wedded husband was, therefore, considered something akin to property damage. As a result, if a husband believed his wife to have been sharing her favours with another man, he could sue that other man for monetary recompense. Mrs. Kendricks entered the parlour carrying the silver coffee tray. Only some of the Thorne family plate had survived the family's various adventures, but the coffee service was still intact, and Mrs. Kendricks insisted on it when there was company, even though the tray dwarfed the round table where she placed it. Thank you, Mrs. Kendricks, Rosalind said. She did not miss the way Mrs. Kendricks kept her eyes lowered, or the tight frown of disapproval on the housekeeper's normally placid face. A pool of disquiet formed in the pit of Rosalind's stomach. She covered the unwelcome emotion with the business of pouring out and inquiring how her guests preferred their coffee. With a bit of milk, if you please. No sugar, thank you. Once they all had their cups in their hands, Rosalind asked the next and the most important question. Against whom is your husband bringing suit? Mrs. Seymour stared at the cup in her hands but made no move to drink. Fletcher Cavendish, she said. Finally, Mrs. Seymour had said something that startled Rosalind, and she could not help looking to Alice for confirmation. Alice nodded. The Fletcher Cavendish, the first man of the English stage. The greatest Shakespearean since Garrick, the man who holds more hearts in thrall than even Lord Byron. But you've read the columns. Has your husband any evidence to support his suspicions? Rosalind did not ask if the accusations were true. That hardly mattered. What mattered was whether they might be believed. Mrs. Seymour cocked her head and regarded Rosalind with a fresh and much cooler gaze. Captain Seymour has been questioning, perhaps I should say badgering, the servants. So far they have remained loyal and steadfast. That may change. But he says he has letters. Between you and Mr. Cavendish? No. He says they are from a third party, one, and here I am using his words, fully informed upon the gross and indecent nature of this act of treachery. For the first time, Mrs. Seymour's musical voice faltered. I was very young when I married Captain Seymour, Miss Thorne. I was an orphaned girl, and desired nothing so much as a home and family to call my own. Rosalind inclined her head in encouragement and understanding. Seymour's family connections admitted me to society of a better class than I had previously known, Mrs. Seymour went on. I gained some popularity for my work, and some for what were considered my personal attributes, meaning her beauty. Probably her conversation as well, but mostly her beauty. I think Seymour liked having such a woman on his arm. He enjoys being the object of men's envy and admiration. He always encouraged me to write and to keep myself active in society while he was away with his ship. But matters changed when he came home. The final defeat of Napoleon had left many an officer facing the complications of a life on reduced pay with no chance of action or advancement. Profoundly. Where once he encouraged me to mix in society, now he accuses me of flirtation and disloyalty. Before, he praised my efforts. Now I am slothful and a disgrace because I do not work hard enough. Mrs. Seymour sniffed. I have borne it as best I can. But now, when we argue, he tells me about the suit. He tells me he has engaged an attorney. He tells me,
He tells me many things. Some of them might be true. I know he is working up the nerve to do the thing, and that it will come to him very soon.
She paused and repeated,
"Very soon."
"Are you even acquainted with Mr. Cavendish?" It happens sometimes that men, especially men in straitened circumstances, simply picked out a rich target for their accusations. Mrs. Seymour turned her head away. Her face had flushed bright red, not in embarrassment, but in anger. "As it happens, Mr. Cavendish and I are well acquainted. We met almost 20 years ago. He was the one who saw my talent for verse and urged me to try for publication. We have always corresponded, and I've never concealed the connection. Mr. Cavendish has visited our house and dined with us. We have accepted invitations to his performances and supper afterwards. That this accusation should come so suddenly, I am bewildered."
"You're not," thought Rosalind. "You're hurt and you're angry, but you understand this all too well."
"The fact of the matter is, Miss Thorne, I would not care whether Seymour brings his ridiculous suit or no, except for one thing." She fumbled in her bag for a handkerchief to press against her eyes. "I am with child, Miss Thorne." Rosalind made no answer. Felicitations did not seem appropriate, given that Mrs. Seymour was struggling against tears that had much more to do with outrage than with sorrow. "Seymour insists the child is not his. If he says this publicly, if he divorces me, then I am not the only one ruined. My child, my son, or, God forbid, my daughter, will be labelled a bastard and must carry the taint of the accusation and their mother's disgrace through their life."
"But how is it you wish me to help you?" asked Rosalind. "I am unacquainted with Captain Seymour. I do not believe he would be dissuaded by another woman."
"He would laugh in your face," Mrs. Seymour said grimly. "No. What I wish is to be proved innocent. Obviously, I am not allowed to appear on my own behalf in court, but if I have some solid evidence of my innocence, perhaps I can persuade Seymour that he will only make himself ridiculous by pursuing the case. I could even plead my case in the newspapers if I must." She nodded toward Alice.
"But I cannot sit idle and helpless while my future and my child's future is decided by my enemies."
It was a strong word, and it pricked Rosalind's curiosity. "Who is advising the captain?" she asked.
"His brother, Sir Bertram, primarily. Sir and Lady Bertram dislike me for failing to be humble enough for my unsatisfactory origins, and yet they are quick enough to take the money I make when it comes in."
Alice nodded once in confirmation and agreement. Despite this, Rosalind felt that there was something wrong in Mrs. Seymour's story and the manner of her address. She could not put a definite name to this kernel of suspicion, but Rosalind was inclined to trust her own instincts.
"Have you seen these letters Captain Seymour is threatening you with?" Rosalind asked.
"I have one." Mrs. Seymour pulled out the folded paper.
"Seymour has hidden them, but I was able to snare this one from his desk."
She handed it to Rosalind. Rosalind opened the letter and read,
"Sir, I strive only to warn you. Last night again, the woman who calls herself your wife was seen at the Theatre Royal and at the King's Arms. She entered the establishment brazenly and alone at such times as she could have had no legitimate business being there. She stayed in both places at least an hour and left again, quite smug and satisfied with herself. Mr. Cavendish himself was not so far behind. Indeed, when she left the hotel, he was with her, and they strolled openly arm in arm, quite comfortable together. I leave it to you to decide what your honour as an officer and a gentleman requires to be done." There was, of course, no signature.
"Could Seymour's brother, you said his name was Sir Bertram, could he be the one writing the letters?"
"It is possible, but I could not say for certain."
"And may I keep this?"
Rosalind held up the paper.
"Of course, if it will be of use. If Seymour missed it, he would have said something by now."
Rosalind folded the letter and made up her mind. "I will make some preliminary inquiries into the matter, Mrs. Seymour. I will not, however, be able to promise anything until I have explored the situation further." Disappointment flickered behind Mrs. Seymour's dark, expressive eyes, but she rallied quickly.
"Of course," she said. We are strangers, you and I. You require assurance that I am speaking the truth. Women do lie at such times, even to their sisters in misfortune. The words stung, not because of the accusation, but because of the blatant attempt at manipulation. If Alice had not been there, Rosalind might well have shown the woman to the door. I do not make promises I cannot keep, Mrs. Seymour. Such matters can be made simple or complex by the nature of the persons around whom the circumstances gather. I must discover for myself the range of personalities involved here. That is the only way in which a practical and complete resolution may be discovered. If this is not acceptable, you must seek help elsewhere. I ask your forgiveness for my hasty words, Mrs. Seymour said. I have been under a great strain lately, and have become used to being called everything from hysterical to dishonest. You will let me know your decision? She paused. I don't wish to be indelicate, but Alice mentioned that there would be a fee. Perhaps you may write and let me know your requirements. If I feel I will be able to help, I will do so. Rosalind took a deep breath. Now, if I agree to look into this matter, I will be seen with you and out on your business. Therefore, we will need a plausible reason for our acquaintance. I believe Alice said you are a poetess? Mrs. Seymour nodded. Very good, said Rosalind. We may say that you are engaged in compiling a new volume, and that I, as a friend, am assisting you with the project. You have, I'm afraid, been suffering somewhat from eye strain of late. Indeed, I have, Mrs. Seymour replied promptly. How good of you to agree to help, Miss Thorne. I cannot thank you enough. And now I must go. Mrs. Seymour got to her feet. She also held out her hand for Rosalind to take. I hope and I pray that you will see your way toward helping me. She squeezed Rosalind's fingertips for just a moment before she let go and glided out of the parlour. Alice glanced back at Rosalind hastily and followed her friend to the foyer so Mrs. Kendricks could help them with their bonnets and gloves. Rosalind stood staring at the parlour door for a long moment. Well, Alice, she murmured, what have you gotten us into? Chapter 3. A Meeting of Like Minds. It is most unwise on the part of any woman to allow her husband to discover of what shreds and patches women are composed. Catherine Gore. Pin Money. I'm not certain your friend likes me, Mrs. Seymour said, as she and Alice Littlefield descended the steps from Miss Thorne's house into the clamour and bustle of Little Russell Street. It was a straight but cramped thoroughfare, its buildings crowded shoulder to shoulder and practically nose to nose. This forced the traffic and the pedestrians to jostle together on the muddy cobbles. Margareta happened to know this street had once held several houses of a much lower reputation than the cramped but decorous parlour where she'd spent her morning. But fashions in neighbourhoods, as in all other things, were subject to change, and this one had begun to attract a more respectable sort of resident. Still, its reputation lingered like a faint malaise. Mrs. Seymour supposed that was among the reasons Miss Thorne had chosen to make her home here after her own disgrace. It was, above all things, cheap. Oh, Margareta, what a snob you've become. Don't worry about Rosalind, Margareta, Alice was saying. She's simply very guarded. I suppose she would have to be. Margareta let herself muse. I expect in her life she must come into contact with all manner of persons. Alice smiled at this, as Margareta hoped she would. If that's an invitation to gossip, I'm going to have to disappoint. Would I ever ask you to do such a thing? Which, of course, made Alice look down her snub nose at Margareta in an attitude that sent them both into peals of laughter. All right, but you cannot blame me for trying. Even a writer of sentimental ballads must have some fodder for her work. I understand. I confess I've tried to winkle a story or three out of her myself, but Rosalind is entirely close-mouthed about those she assists, a fact that you should be glad of. Oh, I am. The women both pulled their hems back to avoid being splashed by the ragman's barrow as he shoved his way past them. A stout and harassed woman signalled him from behind the area railing, and he bumped his barrow across the way. Alice pulled herself and Margareta through a gap in the traffic between a pair of serving women and an oyster seller with his basket. When they'd hit on a clear path again, she cocked her head toward her friend.
"You are telling me the truth about your situation, aren't you, Margareta?"
she asked bluntly. Margareta felt her spirits sag. This was what it had all come to. Even her friends and colleagues had begun to distrust her. She should have known, she supposed. She should have taken more care, planned better.
"Stop this. Regrets will not serve."
"I promise, Alice, every word I have said to you is true."
"What about the ones you haven't said?"
"Clifford, dear."
Margareta felt herself smile. "Those as well."
"Margareta!"
"No, Alice, no more. My nerves are gone. We must talk of something else." Margareta slipped her arm through the newspaper woman's. "Will you come home with me? We could take a dish of tea, and afterwards I'll have my man take you wherever you need to go." Alice hesitated.
"I'm sorry, Margareta, but I've got A.E. Littlefield's society notes to write out, and if I'm late, the Major will have my head."
The Major was the publisher of the London Chronicle, chief among the various papers and periodicals that Alice wrote for. "I understand," said Margareta. "I should be working myself. I've promised Mrs. Duncan 6 new poems for her annual, and I'm woefully behind. Well, at least let me pay for your carriage home."
"There's no need. It's a fine day. I can walk."
"I insist," Margareta told her. "You've done me a good turn this morning. You must allow me to repay the favour." Despite her irrevocable change to a working woman of the middling classes, Alice's genteel pride was still liable to show itself in the odd corners of her life. "That's the difference when you've fallen rather than risen," thought Margareta. "One I will soon become familiar with, if I am not very careful." This time, however, Alice's pride surrendered after only a brief struggle.
"In that case, I accept, thank you."
There was a cab stand where Little Russell and Great Russell Streets met. Alice climbed into the hackney carriage while Margareta gave the appropriate fee and a tip to the man who sat on the box and looked only slightly less dispirited than his horse. Alice leaned out the window, her little face quite grave.
"Margareta, if you've misrepresented any part of this, Rosalind will find you out."
"Are you saying her powers are superior to yours, a trained woman of the newspapers?" Margareta gave the words her finest drawing-room lilt, but the effect was quite lost on Alice.
"She can see through a brick wall," Alice said grimly. "Don't try parlour games on her, Margareta."
"Or on me."
But Alice did not say that. She just nodded, and Margareta stepped back so the hackney driver could touch up his horse. The animal shook itself once in annoyance and walked on. So, that is that. Satisfied that Alice was not looking back toward her, Margareta strode swiftly along the length of Great Russell until it crossed Drury Lane and hurried toward the Theatre Royal. By daylight, the great pale Theatre Royal, commonly called just Drury Lane, showed itself as an oddly graceless building, with its arched windows blanked out by dark draperies and its doors securely shut. Men and women in smocks and aprons scrubbed the steps and polished the glass in the doors. It was all mundane beyond description. Magic was a property of darkness. Margareta smiled at the turn of phrase and tucked it away in the tidy drawer of her mind. Surely she would find a use for it somewhere. The grand entrances at the front of the theatre might be shut up tight, but the doors at the back were flung open wide. Carters and porters hauled crates or canvas-wrapped bundles or sacks of coffee and rolled barrels of beer. Women toted great baskets of fruit or sweetmeats or linens. Margareta sidestepped them all and took herself up to the principal stage door, where a broad-faced man wearing a striped waistcoat stood, watching all the chaos with a sharp eye. "Is Mr. Cavendish in yet, Pauling?" Margareta asked.
"He is, Mrs. Seymour," answered the doorman, without taking his eye off the swarm of activity. "And he asked me to keep an eye out for you. Get yourself right in. Aye there," he shouted to a pair of carters manhandling a wooden crate. "Have a care without you."
Margareta took herself through the door before she could hear the complete recital of the carters' ancestries and personal predilections. To hear Fletcher tell it, the back of the Drury Lane Theatre was the height of luxury, modern order, and cleanliness. Margareta had always taken his word for it. It was more common to hear the theatre's bowels described as a warren. Privately, Margareta thought this was giving warrens too much credit. Surely no rabbit had ever dug such a bewildering maze. Even the new gas lighting failed to lift the gloom of passageways that reeked of dust, paint, hemp, and tar. No carpeting had been laid here to deaden the echo of tromping boots, shouting voices, or the ring of hammers and saws in the scenery shop. Two flights of stairs took Margareta to the surface of the theatre's churning, workaday ocean. The corridor here had the benefit of both matting on the floor and windows to let in light and air. Margareta nodded to the principal mantua maker as that man bustled past, followed by a tiny boy clutching a bolt of blue cloth to his chest. Once they were gone, she was able to cross the passage and knock on the door of Fletcher's dressing room.
"Enter," came the booming reply.
Margareta did, leaving the door open behind her a scant inch, for propriety's sake. Fletcher's position as a principal actor earned him an airy dressing room he had to share only with Edmund Keane. It was furnished with chairs and wardrobes and folding screens, a broad vanity table where he could apply his makeup by the light of good oil and gas lamps, and a broader window to admit the daylight, and Margareta had reason to know the occasional cries of silly, lovesick females. When she walked in, Fletcher was kneeling by the window with a book held up to the light and his free hand pointing at a hapless coat stand. His shirt hung open, almost to the waist.
"Dare your worst, sir. I will not yield," he told the hat stand and paused. "Why do you hesitate? My hands are bound, my breast bared for your blow."
"No, softer, I think." He dropped his voice to a grim stage whisper.
"My hands are bound, my breast bared for your blow."
"I like that better," said Margareta. "Yes, you would, but it might be too subtle for our theatre-going public." Fletcher laid a red ribbon in place to mark his page before he closed the book. "Hello, Margareta. How did your appointment go?" Margareta shook her head, moved the dressing gown off the tapestry chair, and sat down. "Alice's Miss Thorne is not at all what I expected."
"Oh?"
Fletcher tossed the book aside, got to his feet, and set about closing his shirt.
"What was she?"
"Tired, for one thing. Clearly a lady in reduced circumstances, but clearly very intelligent, and Alice respects her abilities, which is an important recommendation."
"Will she take up your calls?"
"I think she will look into me first." He was quiet at this.
"You don't have to go through with this, Margareta."
"Are you going to give me the money, Fletcher?" He hesitated, and she waved her hand.
"No. Of course you are not. I have never asked anything of you but this. But you never do like your women when they begin to make demands." "That is unfair."
"Is it? I am reduced to begging for money. I am about to have my name dragged out for the amusement of the public, my marriage destroyed, and you will not lift a finger."
"Margareta, I do not have the money. According to my man, your captain wants £10,000 in damages."
Margareta felt the blood drain from her cheeks.
"So much? I had no idea."
"I simply don't have that much." He spread his hands.
"Even if I did, he'll only be back for more, and we both know it."
Fletcher paused for a long time. Margareta watched how his eyes cleared.
"Oh, there's a thought."
"What?" Fletcher tapped his chin.
"It is possible that we may yet find a way out of this. I have a potential source of funds yet untapped."
"One of your women?" Fletcher's mobile face fell.
"I haven't had to crawl that low in years."
He picked up his play manuscript and leafed through a few pages.
"This may work, Margareta, but it will only be buying time. Whatever I can raise, Seymour will run through it in a very short time."
"I know," she said again. "But even a little silence will give Alice's Miss Thorne time to work." Fletcher closed the book and turned it over in his hands, running his well-kept fingertips over the leather binding.
"Perhaps we should have married when we had the chance."
"No. Our friendship would not have survived such a marriage as you and I would have made.
If I lost that, I would have far more regrets than any I carry now. No, she said again. We must trust that Miss Thorne can find a way to make this suit more trouble and expense to the Seymours than it's worth.
And after that?
After that is after that. All I care about is that the matter is dropped before Lord Wayland dies. She laid her hand on her belly. Because I know what this is. This is Sir Bertram trying to remove the competition for the title. The Seymours were first cousins to the Marquis of Wayland. Neither the Marquis nor his brother had yet produced legitimate sons. This fact caused the Seymour family to eye the title and the estate that came with it rather like wolves eyeing lambs. If the criminal conversation trial goes forward, I am sure my husband will publicly deny the paternity of my child. Then, if it is a boy, it can never inherit the title, which eliminates a potential bar to Sir Bertram inheriting. Sir Bertram was the younger of the Seymour brothers. That put him decidedly down the line for the Marquishood. If Margaretta had a son, he was pushed back that much farther.
You really believe Bertram's thought this through that coldly?
You've met him and his wife. What do you think?
He may be doomed to disappointment. Lord Wayland has rallied before.
I've been listening to the little birds, and they are all gathering around Lord Adolphus now, in preparation for Wayland's death. Fletcher just shook his head at the name of the younger Wayland. I'm sure that's why my brother-in-law is urging this suit on now.
Lord Adolphus is still a young man, Fletcher reminded her. He could marry and produce an heir of his own.
A fact which Sir and Lady Bertram will certainly address themselves to next. Fletcher faced the window that looked out across the broad cobbled street.
Perhaps I should just walk over to the magistrate's court and tell them all, he said softly. It might be simpler.
If you make that threat again, Fletcher, I will go over and tell them myself. I am not the little girl in the boarding house any more. I do not believe your gestures of self-sacrifice. You said nothing then, you will say nothing now. She laid her hand on his sleeve, so that he turned and met her gaze. Please, Fletcher, get me the money. Let me buy the captain off until I have my proof of Sir Bertram's duplicity to show him.
And then?
I don't know, she admitted. But I can at least shift the balance. Fletcher cupped her chin in his broad, soft hand. Margaretta waited for the shiver of warmth that had once passed between them, but that was long gone.
I'll do what I can, Fletcher promised,
and Margaretta willed her heart and her mind to believe him, just once more. Chapter 4. The Usefulness of the Circulating Library. He gazed on her with admiration and flattered her with attention, and for a long time mutual civilities and favours passed between her husband and the defendant. The trial of William Henry Hall versus Major George Barrow for criminal conversation. On another day, Rosalind might have set straight to work considering the person and the problem presented to her. Her sleepless night, however, had left her muddled and impatient. She could not in good conscience embark upon a new solution in such a state. Neither could she fairly and accurately judge the person of Mrs. Seymour. Therefore, Rosalind set the whole matter aside for a day while she rested, and caught up with her accounts, correspondence, and other such household matters. The following day, much more refreshed and clear in her mind, Rosalind was able to consider a starting point on her path toward a solution for Mrs. Seymour. As always, that path depended upon Rosalind making discreet use of her connections. In London society, connection was a great, tortured, largely invisible net thrown over the lives of thousands of persons. Whom did one know? Who knew one's family and under what circumstances? This determined one's status, whom one could visit, and whom one could ask for favours. Rosalind Thorne had been born into the Haut Temps. Her father, Sir Reginald Thorne, had in his day been possessed of enormous charm and wit, not to mention taste and that ineffable quality called ton. He'd been a sought-after houseguest, and his daughters, Rosalind and Charlotte, had been feted and petted on this account. But like so many young men of his caste and class,
Sir Reginald had regarded money like water. It flowed in rivers from his hands, and when it failed to come in as easily, he simply borrowed more. When he could no longer borrow, he listened to the stories of fortunes to be made in the markets and invested. When the investments failed, he took to forgery to create the notes of credit that would allow him to keep living a life of leisure and grace. But when Sir Reginald was caught signing the name of a friend to a bill, he packed up and left his wife and younger daughter to make what they could out of the ruins. The punishment of social disgrace was immediate, and it would have been total had it not been for Rosalind's godmother, Lady Blanchard, who provided both home and a social lifeline that allowed Rosalind to be received in the great houses by the prominent hostesses, although not quite on the same footing as formerly. The acceptance of one of their number allowed the others to be charitable and to congratulate themselves for being so. But while it might be a tight net and an inescapable one, caution had to be used when tugging on the threads of connection. To society, the only thing more important than connection was appearance. If one was seen using connection in a way that might be interpreted as brazen or forward, it could spell disaster. Therefore, matters must be arranged with a delicate hand. Fortunately, this was Rosalind's specialty, and once she had finished her morning roll and coffee, it took her to Mr. Clement's circulating library. "Good morning, Mr. Clements," Rosalind said, as she pushed through the door. "Miss Thorne," cried the little man behind the counter, "how delightful to see you." Mr. Clements had been born Ernesto Javier Garcia Mendoza Clemente in Argentina. By what route he had come to London, Rosalind had not yet been able to ascertain. But the straight red scar that showed through his thinning hair spoke of an active past, as did the firm and definite way he spoke when saying the greatest felicity a man could know was a perfectly quiet life. "May I ask how you do this morning?" Mr. Clement's English was impeccable, as was his Latin, his Greek, his Italian, and of course his Spanish. A slight hint of lilt and lisp was all that betrayed him as not being a native of London. "I am very well, thank you."
"Excellent, excellent. How is it I can help you? I have a new memoir that might interest you. Very fine."
"Thank you, Mr. Clements, but today I am in search of poetry."
"Excellent."
He clapped his hands together.
"Of what sort? Classical? Romantic?
Devotional?"
"Have you anything by Mrs. William Seymour?" A pained look came across Mr. Clement's mobile features.
"Oh, Miss Thorne, I should not think she would suit your tastes at all."
"I am sorry to disappoint, Mr. Clements, but it is specifically Mrs. Seymour's work I am come to find." He sighed.
"Oh, very well. She is most popular, I will not deny that, but I think we may have one volume left on the shelves. If you will just give me a moment."
He wrote down a note on his pad, tore off the leaf, then let himself through the door behind the counter that led to the stacks. While Rosalind waited for the librarian's return, the bell jangled as the door was pushed open. A plump, open-faced woman in a dark blue Spencer jacket and bonnet bustled into the library.
"Why, Mrs. Buckland," exclaimed Rosalind, "how lovely to see you this morning." "Is that Miss Thorne?"
Mrs. Buckland fumbled for a moment with the spectacles she wore on a gold chain about her neck.
"Why, it is. Good morning, Miss Thorne."
Mrs. Buckland was an amiable woman, of newer money but good repute, as long as one did not cross any of her particularly cherished opinions. Among her exemplary qualities was that she believed in the importance of routine. Whether this was the result of being married to a naval officer and having sailed with him for several years during the early days of their marriage, or if it was some inborn quality, Rosalind could not say. But it was established fact that Mrs. Buckland ran her house and her life according to schedule and rule. For example, at 10 o'clock on Wednesdays, having seen her girls settled at their lessons with their governess, reviewed the day's menus with the housekeeper, and assembled her assorted lists, Mrs. Buckland could, without fail, be found at Clement's circulating library. "How are the children?" asked Rosalind. "And the Admiral?" This polite inquiry elicited a fountain of domestic concerns and triumphs. Angelica was turning into a madcap. Hortense had the croup. Thomas was called up twice for good at Eton. A letter had come from Brendan's commander aboard the Boniface that he was excelling in navigation.
As for the Admiral, why, we hardly ever see him these days.
Mrs. Buckland shook her head, causing the curled fringe on her forehead to swing dramatically.
I would have thought with the peace he would be home more often, but heavens no, there's always something that must be done in that great grey building, and it seems none of it can be done without him. Still, at least he is able to dine with us 3 or 4 times in the week, and I need no longer worry about some French cannonball removing his dear head.
Rosalind smiled at this pronouncement. At that same time, Mr. Clements reappeared from the stacks with 2 books in his hands. These he gave to Rosalind before he turned to greet Mrs. Buckland.
I'm returning these.
Mrs. Buckland gave the librarian several slim volumes.
Have you anything new?
Mr. Clements did. He'd set it aside especially, in fact, the first volume of a new novel by Mrs. Cuthbertson. If Mrs. Buckland would wait just a moment, Mr. Clements retreated once more into the bookroom.
And what is it for you today, Miss Thorne?
Mrs. Buckland gestured toward the books Rosalind had received from Mr. Clements.
I was in the mood for some poetry today, and a friend recommended Mrs. Seymour.
A troubled look crossed Mrs. Buckland's mobile features.
Well, yes, she is reckoned to be very good in her way. A trifle mawkish for my tastes, but then not everyone enjoys Mrs. Cuthbertson.
I believe she is married to a naval man. Mrs. Seymour, that is, not Mrs. Cuthbertson.
Yes, said Mrs. Buckland flatly. That she is, Captain William Seymour.
Oh, Rosalind permitted her brows to arch.
Are you acquainted with the Seymours? I suppose your husband must know so many officers.
Mrs. Buckland sniffed.
Some of them rather more than he would wish to. Oh, thank you, Mr. Clements. This looks marvellous. Now, let me check my book.
Mrs. Buckland pulled a small notebook from her reticule, opened it, and held it up so close to her eyes that her face was nearly obscured.
Yes, yes, I'm sorry to send you back, but Hortense has been plaguing me for Glenarvan.
Mr. Clements bowed in acknowledgement and trotted away again.
I really can't say I approve, Mrs. Buckland sighed to Rosalind. But she'll only get it from someplace else. And I do think girls must read bad books to learn to recognise the good, don't you?
Rosalind agreed this was probably true.
Now, what were we... Oh, yes, Captain Seymour. Well, it's all too bad, really, and I feel for his family, of course. You have to understand, with the peace and everything still in an uproar on the continent, and no one quite sure where everything will settle, great changes are afoot in the Navy. While the blockade and the fighting were going on, every single hand was needed. Many faults might be overlooked, particularly among the officers. That is no longer the case. Half the Admiral's business these days is reading letters from men begging for position or consideration, and turning them down.
May I take it, then, that Captain Seymour has been looking for a new position? Mrs. Buckland suddenly became very engaged in smoothing down her sleeves.
William Seymour has been demanding one. Impertinent man. Presumes heavily on his family's connection to the Marquis of Wayland. We've had to quite strike him off our list for dinner invitations.
Oh, dear, murmured Rosalind. The Marquis of Wayland must be the high connection Mrs. Seymour had alluded to.
Now, that connection may have been enough to get him his commission, Mrs. Buckland went on, but it's up to him to keep it, isn't it?
Naturally, Rosalind nodded. And, of course, it speaks volumes that the Marquis is not intervening for his cousin now.
That's just what I was saying to the Admiral, and he remarked it was very telling that neither the Marquis nor his brother, Lord Adolphus, had spoken up at all for such a close cousin. In fact...
But Mrs. Buckland stopped, and she regarded Rosalind over the rims of her spectacles.
Miss Thorne, are you up to something?
Rosalind raised her chin and assumed a lofty air.
Mrs. Buckland, you can hardly expect me to own such a thing. You are, then.
Further remarks were delayed, however, by Mr. Clement's return with the 3 green Morocco-bound volumes of Glenarvan. Mrs. Buckland accepted these and stowed them in her copious carrying bag.
Well, if you are determined to indulge your curiosity about that family, I happen to know that my friend Mrs. Oldman will have Seymour's younger brother, Sir Bertram, and his wife to dine with her on Thursday. I believe Lord Adolphus may be there as well.
It may be that I can procure you an invitation.
I admit that would be most welcome. I only wish I could return the favour.
It may be you can, said Mrs. Buckland. Angelica is making her come out next season, you know. We've been taking her around a bit now, getting her used to things. Lady Tompkins has arranged a private concert to close out her season. Dolcinetti is singing, and Angel is mad to go, but I have been unable to procure a ticket for love or money. You are so clever at such things, perhaps you might be able to manage?
I hardly like to promise, but there are one or two people I could ask.
Then I'm very glad I happened to run into you. Now, however, I must be off, Miss Thorne. I will have a card sent round to you for Thursday. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Mr. Clement.
Satisfied with the conclusion of her morning's business, Rosalind returned to Little Russell Street. There were, as always, a great number of letters to be answered. There were few things as necessary to maintaining sources of information about the currents of society as the maintenance of an active and varied correspondence. In fact, this morning would not be too soon to begin writing to her various acquaintances who might know something about the Marquis of Wayland and what difficulties existed between him and his cousin, the beleaguered Captain Seymour. Rosalind spent a good hour opening, reading, and sorting the morning's mail, arranging her piles according to whether the letters were personal or business, and the urgency of each. At the bottom of the pile, however, she discovered a letter closed with a seal she'd never seen before. It was an ornate medieval letter C, surrounded by a wreath of laurels. Rosalind broke the seal and unfolded the paper to discover two tickets to the evening's performance at the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane. She stared at the tickets and then at the letter, which was written in a bold, neat and flowing script, and read, "Dear Miss Thorne, it is my very great hope that you will excuse the impertinence of this letter. I was recently informed of your efforts on behalf of Mrs. Seymour and wish to take this opportunity to fully acquaint you with my perspective on the matter. I sincerely hope I will be able to make it clear that the lady is in no way to blame for the fulminations and errors in judgment currently being pursued by that man to whom she is espoused. I hope you will find yourself able to accept the gift of these two tickets to the Theatre Royal, and that you and the companion of your choosing might be willing to accept my invitation to dine afterwards. Yours, with humility and respect, Fletcher Cavendish."
"Well," murmured Rosalind, as she laid aside the tickets and the letter. "Now I wonder, Mr. Cavendish, just what has Mrs. Seymour told you of this business?"